thing we have to fear is fear itself. Fear itself. Fear itself.
From the Center for History and New Media at George Mason University, this is Digital Campus, a biweekly discussion of how digital media and technology are affecting learning, teaching, and scholarship at colleges, universities, libraries, and museums.
Ask not what your country can do for you. Ask what you can do for your country. Fear itself.
This is Digital Campus, episode 71, recorded July 8th, 2011. The ninth circle of Google Plus. Well, welcome to another edition of Digital Campus. I am Amanda French, that camp coordinator, now in residence physically at the Center for History and New Media at George Mason University in Fairfax, Virginia. And I am joined by other illustrious members of the Center for History and New Media, beginning with Director Dan Cohen. Hi, Dan.
Hi, Amanda.
How are you?
I'm not bad.
Good. Tom Scheinfeld, no longer physically here at the center?
No, I've taken up the post of Digital Campus North from you, Amanda. I'm now finally moved in to my new place in Connecticut.
Great. Good to hear from you from there. Mills Kelly, where are you, Mills?
I am across campus in the slowly crumbling Robinson Hall complex. Anyone who's ever visited Robinson Hall knows that I'm not kidding.
I'm probably more likely to visit Tom in Connecticut than I am to visit you in that crumbling building across campus.
Yeah, there's no danger that it will fall on anyone's head in the next decade, but the all the guts of the building, you know, the wiring and the air conditioning and other important things like that are slowly but surely giving it up.
Oh, dear.
Faster than ever, actually. But
this is why we've distributed the Digital Campus crew across the country. all of us are in, like, horrible locations that could be destroyed at any moment. So we need at least one person in New England, one person across campus.
Exactly. It's like the Federal Reserve.
Yeah.
Well, and now
yeah.
that I found out that the secure but undisclosed location for important members of our government is at the Homestead Resort in West Virginia. Sorry, that was undisclosed. It's not at the Homestead Resort. Or maybe it was the Greenbrier, one of those grand hotels, or maybe it was just a Holiday Inn in Columbus. But I definitely want to be there instead of here. So why don't you guys, I'll be CH&M sort of slightly west.
CH&M underground.
Right, exactly. But as long as I get to come up and play golf.
All right. Sounds good. Well, speaking of ways to stay connected from around the country, big news this week has been the release of Google Plus, the social network that many say is a rival to Facebook, a serious rival to Facebook. Anybody have any thoughts about Google Plus, or have any of you managed to get into it, play with it?
I just want to know if Mills is ever going to be on Google Plus, because he has resisted Twitter. Although you're on Facebook, right, Mills?
Well, so far, yes, I'm on Facebook, as I have said before, because I have teenage children, and so and it's necessary.
monitoring service. On
That's
Facebook.
Right. Although, actually, my older son was somewhat distressed the other day because his grandmother has been commenting on his pictures on Facebook, and he's trying to figure out a way to get her to stop doing that, please.
But see, this is exactly the promise of Google Plus.
Circles.
This is exactly why I was very excited about Google Plus, because Google Plus offers you the ability to sort people into circles so that you can have your lame family members circle, your grandmother, your uncle, your father, your second cousin, that kind of thing. And, you know, in another circle, you can have your hip friends and send different streams of content to each of those circles.
So I'm on this, Amanda, and you are too, I think, because I think you added me to a circle.
I am, yes.
And
Are you on the lame work circle? Or the...
See, and this is another promise of Google Plus. It doesn't tell people which circle
they're
in.
Okay, that's what I don't get, is I'm already like confused, and I know people are saying, oh no, this is much more intuitive. You make circles of people just like in real life. Like there's your friends and your family. But I log into Google Plus and I see I've been added to like 59 circles, but I have no idea what those circles are unless I'm doing something wrong. And then I can't share a circle I create. So let's say I created a circle for Digital Campus. Can I expose that to you?
No, you cannot expose it to me. And this is the thing, so, where circles are not groups. And I'm actually a little bit less enthused about Google Plus than I was, because I was like, I need this. I need to be able to, you know, have a certain group of people that I can say cuss words to.
Right.
And have that be separate from professional colleagues whom I don't want to say cuss words to, you know, unless they're really being lame. But they're not groups. It's really not two-way. So that your circles are sort of only your own construct. So when people are adding you to their circles, Dan, you have no idea what they've named their circle, and you don't have any relationship to other people in that circle. It just means that when they say something to that circle, you know, they know that that's only going to the people that they want it to go to. Because on a piece of content by piece of content basis, mm-hmm. it sort of asks you essentially every time, who do you want this to go to?
Okay, but
there is a groups functionality, right? There is also, but like, okay, so I'm not on it either, because Dan, I'm curious to know how you did this. Like, my understanding is it doesn't work with Google apps for your domain. So
right, correct. But I have a second Google account.
Oh, I don't want to go down that road again.
I know. Okay, but I merged them, and when that happened, I lost. Well, I still have access, but under a new name, which no one now, since I made that shift. So both Tom, we should explain to our audience that Tom and I, as I like to think, we are power users. We actually are using like Gmail, except we use it with our own personal domains. And so everything looks like we're using the general Google setup, except somehow we're like, you know, I feel like we've been like labeled pariahs or something by using the more professional version of Google. We cannot get access to certain things. So we have, because
other Google Apps users are like Brown University, and like Brown University, the IT managers there, they don't want to roll out, you know, Google Plus to all of their users right away.
Right.
They want to study it for 3 years,
right,
before they roll it out. So why we don't get the features.
But why doesn't Google like differentiate between personal users of Google Apps and enterprise users of Google Apps, and just say you're one or the other? They could probably figure it out, because I only have one email address at my Google Apps for my domain. It's really bizarre.
What I don't understand is why you and Tom don't, you know, use the email service provided by your ISP, because that's what I do. Like, I have my own domain too, but I'm not using Google Apps with it.
Yeah, I do have, you know, surferdude@verizon.net or something.
No, I've got my somewhere. Own domain. You know, I've got amanda@amandafrench.net, but I don't have that through.
Right. See, this is Google the distinction. Apps. And this is actually just to, I'm sure our audience is wondering what we're talking about. But as we move into the educational space, this is really the problem, right? Is so I have a Dan@DanCohen email address. I used to have two Google accounts. Both of them named Dan@DanCohen.org, but one of them was a Google Apps, Dan@DanCohen.org, and the other one was I signed into Google with Dan@DanCohen.org. And this is only going to get worse as, let's say, Brown University, you would have your DanCohen@Brown.edu, which behind the scenes is being run by Google Apps, and you can't use that email address to then create a independent Google profile. And this is what it comes down to. And I think something that I think is very interesting here is that it really, there was this thing that no one used called Google Profiles, which was sort of like your homepage on Facebook, whatever, your profile page on Facebook. No one used it. Now it's suddenly very important. And you can only have one email address, primary email address, associated with your profile. See, and for me, I can no longer make that Dan@DanCohen.org.
Okay, Dan,
I'm sorry.
Dan, can you explain that all from the beginning again?
As host, I forbid that.
I know. We're really confusing. Yeah. This is the bottom line, right? You need an email address, right? Single email address to have a Google account. But that email address cannot be one that is run by Google Apps for your domain, whether that domain is your personal domain like dancohen.org, which I own, or gmu.edu or what have you, or you know, ibm.com. You can't use that email address to create a Google Plus account. And so I think right now, for if they want to get, let's say, the college market, they're going to lock out every college, university, institution.
They're going to lock out their best customers.
Exactly.
Well, but here's the thing, yeah. too. Number one, I have heard that they, just yesterday, Google's president of enterprise posted a note, some kind of blog post or something, in which he said, okay, we are working to roll out support for Google Apps customers for Google Plus. But the other thing that I heard, and I heard elsewhere, just sort of more on the rumor scale, nothing official from Google, that's going to be by the end of July. But the other thing that I've heard about Google Plus is that right now they are not allowing sort of corporate or organizational Google profiles. Like you can't make a Google profile for George Mason University or for that camp or anything. It has to be personal and individual. And I would think that eventually for Google Plus, they will allow that kind of organizational profile. But I think, you know, that may be that maybe they're planning to charge for those or who knows what.
My problem with Google services, and I mean, I'm a big user of them, but is that, and I think Google Plus and this whole issue we're talking about now is symptomatic of this. It's that none of them connect in any meaningful way. I mean, and maybe Google Plus was supposed to be intended to be the remedy to this. But in fact, I think it actually just is more proliferation of Google services. Like Google actually, as far as I can tell, all of the functionality in Google Plus was like already in other Google applications, you know, like you could make circles of contacts. Like why didn't they, you know, like why didn't they just build out contacts
or
like
if they're,
you know, like why didn't they build, you know, it's sort of like Wave. Why didn't they just build out Google Docs? Like why they keep like adding services that don't connect and kind of duplicating functionality of other services. And it seems to me that like if they're going to try to compete with Facebook or something, I mean, the nice thing about Facebook is it's so tied together. Everything just kind of is right there for you, and all their stuff. It's a single UI. It's not like all these different tabs in your browser and maybe Google Plus is supposed to be the remedy to that. But I think
Amanda will agree, and probably you were about to say this, Amanda. I'm sorry if I cut in, but I do think actually they're trying now to integrate it. Like when you log into Google Plus, there's a black bar across the top. There's a red notification square that tells you when you've gotten pinged from any number of circles or places, et cetera. So in a sense, there's now a universal Google inbox for across the Google thing. So now when I'm logged into this new account that I had to set up to use Google Plus, I've got like a black bar across the top. Yes, it's got a zillion services like Docs and Reader and Calendar and stuff like that, but it also has a plus section, which is at the far left, showing how important this is to Google. That's me, you know, it's me plus, and I can go there, look at my profile, just like you do in Facebook, and you know, add people, etc. And there's an inbox. So let's say even if I'm just out, like let's say in Google Reader or in Google Docs doing some writing, I see like a red notification that like I've been invited to a huddle or a hangout, which we should discuss because there are actually some pretty cool new services with video and with group discussions that I don't think they could have replicated in Gmail.
Right, and I definitely agree with you, Dan, that it actually is kind of really well integrated. And you know, as somebody who uses Google Docs and Google Calendar a lot, even today I was kind of trying not to use Google Plus and sort of accidentally was using it because it's got that little red notification
thing.
Just when you're in Google Docs, and you're like, oh, what's going on? But the other thing is, yeah, we should talk about particularly the Hangouts and sort of things, because I think that's where the educational applications could really come in. So number one, this promise of Google Plus that you can share content with specific groups of people, even though they aren't exactly groups, they're like groups on one end, that's going to be good for education, because, you know, you can essentially set up a circle that has your students in it and only share things with them. So there's that. But then Hangouts in particular is, it's really great. You can have up to 10 people at a time video chatting from within Google Plus. Now, obviously, one problem with that is that, you know, Google Plus is not open to everybody right now. So, you know, you'd be lucky to have 9 of your students who already belong to Google Plus. But once more people can join it, and if they do up that number to more than 10, I think that could be really great. You could bring in guest speakers, that sort of thing, really easily.
Can have a seminar. I mean, I was thinking that would
actually be really nice.
Individual webcams, mind you. So it's,
right. And what's neat is that the Hangout stuff, it can be open too. So you could be, you know, another sort of great potential academic application is you could have like a virtual office hours where you'd open up a Hangout and hang out there for an hour or two, and students could just drop by and pop into the Hangout. You'd see them on video. You could talk about things with them. You could have a couple of students if they're interested in the same topic, or you could schedule something. But it's a little bit more open-ended than the Skype or other video connections where it's like you're calling someone and, you know, we just rang each other up on Skype to start a podcast at an appointed time. It's a little bit more, I do think they got this right, that it's sort of like, oh, I see there's 3 people online. I'm going to open up a Hangout room. And you just launch the camera on your laptop or what have you, and you're just hanging out in there. And I think that, you know, I think it was Jenna Wortham of the New York Times. She really nailed that as a kind of killer application, that kind of open-ended group Hangout via video application might really be the piece of this that works in a lot of different settings. I mean, it could have a business application. It could have an education app application. I mean, they're selling it as a, you know, just a friends sort of thing, but it could be much more than that. And so I think in that way, it's a real challenge to what's going on with Skype. I mean, you know, let's say faculty interviews, first round of faculty interviews, it'd be much easier to do it on Google Plus than to try to, we've often had trouble just getting people to like get on Skype, get the camera to work, all that stuff. So having a really easy way to have a video room like this is going to be a big deal.
Wait, I actually tried to use at that camp a service called Tiny Chat, which is at tinychat.com, and it's exactly the same idea. You can have up to 12 people using their own webcams, video chatting, and then there's a text chat as well. So actually any number of people can be in the text chat. And we tried to use that to have the joint virtual session with that Camp Liberal Arts Colleges and that Camp Prime. And it didn't work just because we wanted, you know, there were more than 12 people, so we were trying to use like one camera per place, and just there was terrible audio. It just didn't work at all. But I still thought that was a great, I was still kind of really excited by it, because that notion that you can have, you know, a video conference call really easily was still pretty great to me. But it didn't surprise me that, you know, tinychat.com itself was covered with ads. Many of them were very sketchy. You know, it seemed to have an almost fringe chat roulette kind of feel to it. Not that I've ever been on chat roulette. but it struck me as something that wasn't, you know, even though I was, again, thinking this could be great for classrooms, you know, for just little educational things, it wasn't something that I necessarily feel super comfortable about using with younger students, just because of that sort of look and feel. So the Google Hangout thing doesn't really have that problem. It really seems like a nice, clean, quasi-professional space to be in. So, and Dan, do you know much about huddles? I really don't know anything about that. So maybe that's the group function that people are looking for more.
Yeah, I mean, you know, I really haven't had time to fully check this out. But And because of this conflict between my, like, I guess, professional account and personal account, it's a little bit hard to get these things running at the same time. But, you know, I think that, you know, the, you know, there's almost too many circles things going on.
Yeah.
I think nine circles should have been the limit. You know, there is precedent for that.
There is indeed, Mills. What a nice literary reference. I promise not to put you in the lowest circle, Mills.
Okay.
So, I mean, so a huddle is, so it's the group, but it's text rather than video, right? So, and you can actually, my sense is you can have way more than 10. Unlike the Hangout, I'm going to get all these things like confused. Too many H words. So the Hangout is this open-ended group video chat room. The huddle basically takes one of your circles and then just opens it up to a kind of personal chat area. And I think what's interesting here is it creates a kind of specialized back channel, and that might be useful. I mean, I can imagine huddles working at a back camp or a, let's say, you know, the American Historical Association meeting, where you might not want to share with everybody via something like Twitter, but you want to share with a lot of people. So, I mean, it's a great way if, like, every student in a particular dorm wanted to, like, be part of some text messaging system that was sort of local, it's like a local net for that group. Mm-hmm. Does that make any sense?
Yeah.
Yeah. So, I mean, it's all around these notions of circles and then what you want to do with those circles, whether you want to post something to a circle or chat with the circle or do video with the circle. It's kind of all based on that. And I think a lot of it hinges on whether people are willing to make these circles of people. And I think there's been a lot of debate about that, about whether people are actually willing to do that. Like, are people willing to make lists on Twitter?
I found that one of the most fun parts. There's been was creating the lists of people, sorting people into these different circles. And it should be noted too that you can put the same person in more than one circle.
Right.
So I created a kind of a professional circle, but then I created a CHNM circle, and Dan exists in both of those circles. So, absolutely. I mean, like, if you have one takeaway from Google Plus, it's that, the promise of Google Plus is precisely being able to separate your personal from your professional identities.
Yeah. Yeah.
You know, your separate social roles on a piece by piece basis. You know,
yeah,
here's a thing that I want to say. What's the right audience for that piece of content? And I think that somebody remarked, I'm sorry, I don't remember who or where, whether it was on Google Plus or Twitter or where, but somebody remarked, you know, Google Plus is the first social network that has been deliberately engineered for post-college adults. And that seemed to me to be really right. You know, that problem of what do I want to say to my family versus what do I want to say to other people is one that nags at me a little bit in my use of social networks.
I'm sitting here with an old Gmail account, like, playing with this, and it does look, Amanda, I think you're absolutely right, the design is like a very adult kind of design, even at that level.
Except that the circles are really fun. they do all these nice little visual things. They kind of bloom when you drag things into them, and reportedly they kind of explode when you delete them and things like that. They're fun to play with.
Yeah. It is well designed. I mean, we got to give credit to them that I think they got a lot of things right. I just think the exact use cases for our crowd, you know, I mean, in libraries, archives, museums, and universities, I think there are actually maybe some very neat professional reasons to use this. I could completely imagine some courseware being built upon it, and I assume that's why it's a little bit delayed in being activated for Google Apps enterprise users or even personal users, is that they're thinking about those kinds of things. But it still may be like a little too complicated.
We should move on.
Yeah.
But I have to say, I agree, just because I'm experiencing some cognitive dissonance in that circles are not groups, you know?
Yeah.
Meaning that people, I mean, an extreme case of this is, you know, I can put somebody into my intimate personal friends category, and they can put me into some I barely know this girl
right.
category, right? And so, she right. can send me things that are just exclusively professional links, whereas I'm sending very intimate things, and they all kind of come up in the same
yep.
stream.
Yep.
And that's... It's a little weird. It's right. because people don't have a shared notion of what the group is.
You don't know where you stand in that conversation.
Exactly.
I mean, if I could just say one last thing, I've been feeling this issue too of like how to, you know, what I use Twitter almost entirely professionally, and occasionally there's something semi-personal in there, but like basically it's a professional network. I've been thinking of rejoining Facebook, but like not friending any of you guys. And you know, just
fine. Using
it. Well,
just
I mean,
that makes me sad.
Actually,
but no, you won't be able to friend me. I'm
I ain't friending
it.
You either.
I'm sort of joking. I probably actually would end up, but with people who I'm close with, you know, friends, family,
right.
Mm-hmm. And, you know, and using those two services just differently. And I just wonder if trying to build both of those, you know, even with a circles functionality, maybe it's just they're just two different things that like you use Facebook with your friends and you use Twitter or something else with your colleagues, and that's the I just wonder if this is a circle that kind of can't be squared like that.
Yeah.
So to speak.
Yeah.
Excellent
well,
wordplay.
I just did one final word on this. I just added Tom to my Google Plus circle called Dead to Me. So there you go. All right. Well, we can move on now. Dead right. to Me circle.
Well, speaking of things that are dead, there was a nice article that came out in the Chronicle recently about some researchers at Old Dominion University who are trying to figure out how much of the web is archived so that when content dies, like Tom on the internet, we can discover whether or not that's backed up. So, Mills, you want to tell us a little bit about why you found this story interesting?
Yeah, I thought it was interesting because we've, you know, as historians, we've assumed that that there's going to be an archive to work from when we think about all these electronic sources. And certainly I know I teach my own students how to use the Internet Archive, which is, you know, a fantastic resource for them. But I've never really questioned what percentage of web content is actually being archived by the Internet Archive, and also the degree to which that's a... you know, a transnational archiving process, or is it sort of more skewed toward North America, or exactly, you know, any of those kind of underlying issues with the Internet Archive, I've never really questioned. I just know that it's there, and it is archiving tremendous amounts of great stuff, and or great, because I'm a historian and I love archives. But so a couple of computer scientists at Old Dominion University here in Virginia decided to begin a process of kind of rigorously testing what is being archived online, or what kind of online content is being archived and where. And the story that came out in the Chronicle this past week was essentially kind of a first look in at that research, which doesn't tell us a whole lot. It tells us that that they're working on it and that they have some some very preliminary conclusions and sort of what they're, if you go from the Chronicle story onto their own blog and read through some of the technical notes of what they're up to. I mean, what's nice about it from my perspective is by the time they've sort of been through multiple iterations of this, they will have come up with a methodology that I think will give us a really clear picture of how much of the web is actually being saved on any given day. Right now, you know, they've got a huge range of answers, you know, anything from 30% to 90%, and it depends on what kind of site it is and that sort of thing. But at least it's a much more rigorous attempt than we've seen in years past to tell us what is being saved and what isn't. And you know, this is something that, you know, the founder of the Center for History and New Media, Roy Rosenzweig, began worrying about a long time ago in internet years, you know, more than a decade ago. And and it's something that as historians we just, you know, we talk about a lot, and of course there's a lot going on out there in the world of digital infrastructure to address this issue. But I found the story kind of interesting because it seemed like it was more rigorous than the things that I've seen before. Dan, I don't know, what's your take on this?
I saw this story and just briefly looked at it, but were they considering whether things had been archived in Internet Archive? I couldn't really understand where they were.
Various databases.
In various databases. The Internet Archive was just one of the places.
It was one of them.
Yeah.
Yeah. Okay. Okay. It was a little bit unclear from, I guess, the story.
Yeah, that was, in fact, part of what they were trying to do is look beyond the Internet Archive.
Yeah. I thought that was really interesting that there were all these other places where they potentially could be backed up that I think a lot of people hadn't thought about, right?
Right.
Some of them, including
Congress, runs a big digital preservation program, part of which is archiving important websites.
Right. Although even there, so they've archived 240 terabytes in 40 different events, which it sounds like a lot, but it's really just scratching the surface of the web.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, they were just sort of testing,
and it's topical. So you know, they archive law blogs, but they don't archive history blogs.
And it's really slices too. It's slices of the Internet Archive. I mean, they're using the Internet Archive's technology. They're telling the Internet Archive kind of what to go grab, and then they're duplicating a copy of what the Internet Archive grabs at the library. Is that right? I mean, it's
yeah.
Well, I think they're right. I think they're using their technology, but I think the data itself ends up at the Library of Congress.
Okay,
is my understanding. I think yeah,
I think it ends up in both places.
It speaks to something that I was kind of wondering about this, which is the difference between backed up and archived. Because I worked in the Archives and Public History program at NYU a couple years ago, and I happened to read a paper by a student who was doing just a survey just from the literature. About who was doing web archiving internationally. And a number of foreign governments, I've forgotten who, I want to say something like New Zealand, have taken the initiative to make sure that all of the things with their country's domain are backed up and archived. But you know, the difference between backed up and archived is kind of a big one in the sense that, like, okay, you can save a copy of something on another server, but, you know, there are web archiving programs that, you know, will, you know, make sure that the links resolve and make sure, you know, if they're link shorteners, that kind of thing, they'll add in descriptions and metadata and all that kind of thing. So I that wasn't totally clear to me. It sounds like this particular project is looking at, you know, has a copy been saved of this web page?
Yeah, I think that's right.
Well, mm-hmm. So here's my issue on it is I was surprised that the numbers were as high as they were, although there was a great range, you know, between 30% and 90% or whatever.
Mm-hmm.
You know, if you had just asked me off the top of my head, I would have said 10%, you know, or 5%. If you just take a random web page, that web page has been copied somewhere else. But, you know, speaking of Roy, you know, Roy had talked about, I think, particularly a kind of digital dark age of, let's say, the first 20 years of the web, where just a lot of stuff was lost even before the Internet Archive, right? Or even, let's say, the first 5 years of the web or the first 10 years of the web. I actually wonder if we're now in the worst moment for the archivability of the web, considering what, just what we just talked about, like Google Plus, like where is that content? We couldn't even describe cogently, coherently where stuff goes when you share it with a circle, right?
Right.
Like, does it have a URL that's permanent? Mm. You know, on a page that's somehow archivable? At least, actually, a Twitter object has a page. I mean, it literally is twitter.com/DanCohen/status/a number. But there's a lot of stuff that is now kind of in this screwy middle ground or nowheresville. I mean, everything on Facebook, essentially, right?
Yeah.
And then everything that is in this very sort of the moment way of producing websites with hash bangs where, you know, there's the number sign and an exclamation point and everything's driven by JavaScript and content that is loaded into parts of the page, but nothing is really static. And, you know, everything's all Ajax-y and messed up. It's, you know, at least the early web, there was like a web page with, you know, index.html. And now we've got all these moving pieces even within web pages.
Right.
I kind of fear that we're losing a lot of the archivability of the web.
Yeah, I actually, just the Google Plus thing, I learned that just earlier today. I was trying to point somebody to an earlier thing I had posted on Google Plus, and I definitely could not find a unique URI for it. All I could do was reshare it with like the share button, but that share button did not link to a particular URI that I could,
right.
I mean, it must have had it encoded in there somewhere, but I didn't have access to it just from the front end that I could tell.
Yeah, and I thought what was interesting is when they launched Google Plus, they also made another publicity push with this Google Data Liberation Front, which was,
right.
my sense was started internally from some Googlers who really wanted to be able to get stuff in and out of services, not, you know, theirs and others. And they created this process called Google Takeout, where you can take your data out of things, including actually, it was ready right for the launch of Google Plus. You can take all of your shared pieces out of Google Plus if you want. But again, like, is that really archiving what's gone on? It's all you're getting is a kind of zipped file of the words that you wrote on a post. But the actual web itself, if you were to look at it in the present moment, is like a composite of what you wrote, what other people commented upon. Maybe there's a YouTube video that you shared. It's not going to include the YouTube video. So it's a messy kind of heterogeneous environment that to me is going to be really problematic. I wonder what the Internet Archive is doing about those kinds of web objects.
I mean, I don't know that they're doing anything. I mean, the Library of Congress famously is building a Twitter archive. And Audrey Waters recently wrote kind of an update on that, you know, the Library of Congress Twitter archive 1 year later, because that was announced back in spring of 2010. And essentially, it's such a difficult problem. They're trying to do kind of almost exactly what you're talking about, Dan, trying to create a way for researchers to access this data in a way that's going to be really useful for them. The Library of Congress right now is getting dumps. They're getting basically JSON data from Twitter. There's these kind of, you know, they're actually not very big as files, but they're very big considering that they just consist of a lot of text, you know. But just the file itself is not necessarily all that useful. So one of the things that they're trying to do is make sure that all the link shorteners resolve. And so they're working with things like Bitly and TinyURL to make sure that they've got resolvers that will, you know, if somebody shares a link, what does that link point to is something you kind of need to know. And they're also trying to build in some of the kind of network queries that you would want to do. Who does so-and-so follow, you know, is not necessarily something that's in that JSON data that they're getting. But as far as Facebook or certainly Google Plus,
right.
I don't think there's anything like that.
Right, and I mean, I'm thrilled that the library is doing this, and I think this and Twitter is the place for them to start. But in the end, I mean, Twitter as social networks go is the low hanging fruit, because it's the interactions are, you know, comparatively simple.
And public.
I mean, it's really, you know, I mean, you share links, you share and you address things, you know, very transparently to individual people. You know, with a kind of very simple naming convention, the at thing and hashtags and things like that. I mean, it really is, it's really simple compared to something like Facebook, where you're doing, you know, a whole lot more, you know, with photos and groups and other features. So, you know, I think that's the place for them to start, but I think something like Google Plus is infinitely more complex and more and difficult to archive.
I like to imagine that future historians will have some entirely unthought of methodology that we can't even conceive of yet. Like maybe it'll be okay for historians in the future to just make stuff up, and that'll be history. Like everybody will
good.
Be writing fictional alternative history. And
I'm teaching that class again in the spring. It's called Lying About the Past.
Lying About the Past. Ooh, I'm there. Can I audit that?
You sure can.
All right.
Tuesday, Thursday afternoons.
Okay. So
John, since you have the time.
Sure. I'm just interested to see what hoax you come up with this time.
Yeah. Well, it won't be me. It'll be the students.
Let's see what websites you can get banned from again, Mills.
Right. But for sure, it will not be a pirate hoax this time.
Okay.
It's going to be banned from Google Plus.
So, Mills, are you going to use Blackboard to teach this course of yours?
There's more chance of me joining Twitter than there is of me joining Blackboard, even now that they've gone private.
They have indeed gone private. This story is sort of... It continues to be like one of the most emailed on Inside Higher Ed, for instance, even though in a way there's not that much to the story. The story is Blackboard got bought. And one of the only key points about that is that Blackboard is no longer a publicly traded company. It is now owned by a private equity holding firm, whatever that is. All I know that means is that there are no shareholders, as I understand it.
They're partners. But the thing that I thought was really interesting about that story was not the fact that, okay, Blackboard got bought, so somebody made some nice premium on their stock. But I think the real interesting story is the reason why Blackboard was kind of in play, and that is that they're starting to suffer from declining market share. And that's because there are a whole bunch of alternatives that are appearing in the marketplace. Some of them for fee, some of them open source, and so I think that there are an awful lot of universities around the country, George Mason being one of them, that are really tied into this one service, Blackboard, in a whole variety of ways. I mean, I noticed the other day that the checkout cash registers in our student union building are run by Blackboard. And so it's not just the kinds of things that we tend to talk about, the course management and that kind of thing, but it's lots of the administrative software on campus, apparently. But I thought it was very interesting that they are, according to the financial pages, facing declining market share.
Oh, that's interesting. I had no idea. I kind of assumed that it got bought because it was making obscene amounts of money.
Now, one of the stories I read said that private equity firms buy like this particular one, buy companies because they generate income, or because they're sort of two reasons: one, they generate income, or two, they have a lot of upside, a lot of growth potential, and that Blackboard had fallen into the steady stream of income category, that they were going to continue to generate a fair amount of cash for the owners, but that they were not seen as a growth potential company, and that in fact there was a fair amount of speculation that the new owners would cause Blackboard to jettison some of their kind of more peripheral activities and focus more on their core business. So you don't
the
tend
higher
to do,
margin stuff.
Yeah, the higher margin stuff. You don't tend to do that if you that kind of thing if you are still in a real growth mode.
What is the higher margin stuff that Blackboard does?
The course management software.
Oh.
That stuff is very profitable. And not just very profitable, but just, insanely expensive for colleges and universities, because it's not like you sign up for Blackboard the way you sign up for Gmail and it just works. It's you have this whole staff of people. I don't know how many people we have working here at George Mason whose responsibility it is to make it possible for people to use this software product. But it's some number of people drawing a pretty good salary to, at least I hope they're drawing a pretty good salary, to make it possible for us to use a product that we're paying somebody else for.
Well, yeah, but none of that money, none of that staff money goes to Blackboard, and that would be the
right.
Same, we'd still have that staff time, at least that much staff time, if we adopted all open source.
Sure.
It's funny. It seems it's one of the things that I thought was interesting about this, about at least the response to the story was, it seemed like a lot of campus IT professionals started saying, and decision makers sort of started saying, well, this has really given me pause, and it's making me think that maybe we'll start looking around for alternatives, or at least start considering alternatives. And what I don't get really is, this really gave them pause that, like, it's basically, it was a for-profit company, and now it's a for-profit company, and this is the thing that's giving them pause. Reading between the lines, it sort of seems to me that this is something that they maybe were thinking about doing anyway. You know, like these campus IT professionals were sort of thinking of moving away from Blackboard anyway, and this is kind of, this has like a forcing function. You know, this is maybe a straw that broke the camel's back, but it just doesn't seem to me to be so serious a development, and that it would really change your mind about the software if you weren't willing to have your mind changed about the software.
Yeah, I don't think there's going to be any change in the sort of day-to-day experience of campus IT people just as a result of Blackboard being, you know, having new owners.
Right. So it seemed to me like it the story uncovered some kind of latent dissatisfaction with the company, with the product. You know, gave people an opportunity to sort of publicly rethink something that they had been privately rethinking anyway.
I always feel like there's a little bit of a cattle call like effect with some of this software. I mean, including open source software. A lot of when you're deciding as an institution what software to invest in, the idea that a lot of other people have invested in it is always a factor to be considered. You know, partly because it's like a lot of votes that this is good software. So the more people tend to adopt it, the more people tend to adopt it. But then also because, you know, it seems to suggest, well, there are resources for help with the software. So I don't know. Yeah, it may be almost like a bubble in the stock market. That everybody adopted Blackboard because you kind of had to have a course management system. And maybe now that very notion that you have to have a course management system is disintegrating.
I hope so too.
Thank you.
Well, we're nearing the end, I think, of our podcast, but I thought it might be nice to hear from Dan and Tom in particular about a new initiative of the Center for History and New Media, which I did think made the news. I think it is news. Tom and or Dan, would you like to tell us a little bit about Press Forward?
Tom, do you want to go first?
Tom, why don't you begin?
Tom, do you want to do the press part or the forward part?
Tom we may have lost Tom.
It's just too much for him.
Yeah. Tom had to go get a triple latte.
Oh, shoot. I had my microphone muted. Sorry. Dan, you go ahead.
Yeah, I'll start.
I clearly am not all here today.
Tom, I am calling on you. I see your virtual hand raised in the
Tom,
Skype.
Tom was just considering a leveraged buyout offer from a private equity firm.
Yeah, actually, the big news for this Friday is I've sold Press Forward, Dan.
holy cow. Oh, my gosh. I knew it.
Does that mean we still have to do the work?
I don't know. Ask our new overlords at the private equity firm. Anyway, sure, I can say a little bit about Press Forward, yeah, and Dan, jump
like
in.
I've said so many things about it in different forums. So
yeah, jump in when you feel like it. You know, I think this is something that we've been tossing around for a long time. You know, essentially, we are working with the help from the Sloan Foundation on a new model for publishing scholarly work that is going to rely on kind of web-native practices and web-native ways of working to expose quality scholarly work that's out there on the greater web. So things like blog posts, things like white papers, working papers, other what you might call gray literature. We're going to create a set of tools and algorithms and editorial workflows for exposing that material, aggregating it, and publishing it in a series of disciplinary I guess the closest thing you would call them are journals. You know, we're still working through what exactly these journals are going to look like. They're going to look different for different disciplines. At first, we're going to be launching, Dan, I think it's five, right, of these publications.
Five.
One which our listeners may already be familiar with is Digital Humanities Now, which is just that it's an aggregator of work, scholarly writing, and other news and material on digital humanities, and that uses Twitter in this case, because that's a technology that the digital humanities crowd uses a lot, to identify quality work, the kind of work that's getting attention by scholars, that's published on various blogs and news sites and in working papers and other places, to aggregate that and expose it to audiences. We're going to be doing that for American History with a journal that's going to be edited by Mike O'Malley, American History Now. We're going to be doing it. Mills is going to be editing a journal. Mills, what's your title? Your working title?
It's Global Perspectives on Digital History.
Global Perspectives on Digital History. Amanda, you and I, so we're all kind of involved in this. You and I are going to be editing Proceedings of That Camp, so we're going to be aggregating the best blog posts and collaborative documents and even Twitter back channel discussions that come out of the VAT camps that are going on all around the world. We're going to be aggregating that material and editing it and republishing it as Proceedings of That Camp. What am I missing, Dan?
No, I think that you've gotten most of the details in. I would say, just in general, to kind of wrap up, it's a way for us to provide a much wider array of publishing outlets than currently exist. That I think we've been, as probably a lot of our audience have been, a little depressed at the rate of change in scholarly publishing, that there's only certain kinds of genres that continue to exist, that have very standard formats of, in history, the 8,000 word essay or the 80,000 word monograph, and that it seems to us that there's a lot of different ways to do scholarship, especially in a digital age, and that if we could find ways to aggregate those from across the web to validate them and credit them, that would be a positive development. And I think it's going to be a project that involves a lot of experimentation and a lot of different models. There won't be just one press forward model. I think things will be very different. Mills's project, for instance, will involve multiple languages and what happens when you have a journal that's in multiple languages, and that's international. Digital Humanities Now is more on the algorithmic side of things, where, how much of a journal can be automated in terms of finding the best material that's out there. There might be other things that are more human-centric, that really involve an editorial board and look maybe a little bit more traditional, but might focus on multimedia or heterogeneous web kinds of publications. So I think what we're just trying to do is open up a much broader space for publication and to find ways that work and to get audiences for these new publications. And, I think we'll continue to update it on the podcast.
Well, great. Thanks for telling us about that. And we'll keep an eye on that. And thanks to all of you for your insights into the most recent news stories that have to do with technology and libraries, archives, museums, and universities. And we'll hope to hear from you again on the next episode of Digital Campus.
The only thing we have to fear is fear itself. Fear itself.
Please visit us online at digitalcampus.tv, where you can join in the discussion and let us know about stories and issues you would like us to cover on future episodes. Mike O'Malley wrote our theme music.
Ask not what your country can do for you. Ask what you can do for your country.